Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 10th of August 2019, episode 2. And there's a fair number of gigabytes to be loaded up at about 1 megabyte per second up my line up to store all the Glenn Brooks history. So it means that I'm reading a few articles, and it'll be a while before this gets uploaded. Okay, rejection-free transplants. We may be able to train the body not to attack donated organs. People having organ transplants in the future may not have to take anti-rejection medicines thanks to a technique that could be made their immune system see the donor's tissue as their own. The method involves giving the recipient an infusion of the donor's cells a week before the operation. So it wouldn't work for those who were getting an organ from someone who had died, but it would be suitable for those with a living donor, such as some kidney, liver, pancreatic cell transplants. When the technique was tested in 5 monkeys, transplanted pancreas cells stayed healthy without being rejected for up to 2 years. It was the very early days, but if it works, it's a completely genuine game changer, says Chris Callaghan at Guy and St. Thomas's Hospital in London, who was involved in the study. Transplants of organs such as kidneys, livers and hearts can be life-saving, but recipients have to take medicines for the rest of their lives to damp down their immune system and avoid the new organ being rejected. These new drugs have serious side effects, such as leaving people more prone to infections and cancer. So, a way to force the immune system to accept a donated organ has been sought for decades. Bernard Herring of the University of Minnesota and his colleagues explored the way that immune systems can learn not to attack our own cells. Throughout our lives, cells naturally die through the process called apoptosis. And are shed into the bloodstream. Immune cells in the spleen take them in and remember their molecules to signify the body's own cells, not invading microbes, and so should be tolerated. It is possible to mimic the process by treating cells with a chemical called ECDI that triggers apoptosis. Herring and his team introduced a condition similar to type 1 diabetes into 5 monkeys. They then treated these monkeys with pancreatic cells transplanted from the donor monkeys. A week before the transplant, each sick monkey was given an infusion of EDIC-treated blood cells from the donor. They received another dose the day after the transplant. They were also given anti-rejection drugs for 3 weeks. Even after the drugs were stopped, the cell transplant stayed healthy and produced insulin for 2 years in one animal. The point at which the study ended, and 1 year from the rest. The approach could eventually use people who receive kidney transplants or part livers from living donors, says Herring. In the UK, about a third of kidney transplants from such donors who are usually relatives or friends. Bees' hairy tongues help them mop up thick or thin nectar, zoology, and this is written by Ruby Prosser Scully. Bumblebees can gorge on goopy nectar just as easily as they can slurp up runny comb, and now we know why. It's all down to tiny hairs on their tongues. Close look at the bee's tongue reveals long rod-like stalk that have covered with thin hair-like protrusions. That makes it look like a little tiny mop, and the bee dips in and out of flowers to drink with sweet nectar. Pascal Darman, the University of Mons in Belgium, and his colleagues analysed videos of buff-hair-tailed bumblebees, Bombus pterus audax, feeding on nectar on different viscosities, and made an unexpected discovery. They found that regardless of the fluid thickness, the bee lapped up their dental rate, collecting the same volume of liquid in each time they inserted their tongue. This is a surprise because, in theory, thicker liquids should be more likely than thin ones to stick to an object dipped in one solution. Researchers 3D printed rods that were either smooth or covered with tiny structures to mimic the bee's hair-like protrusions. They then dipped the rods into fluids of different viscosity. It turned out that the distance between the microstructures and the rods explained the puzzle. If they were spaced close enough to one another, then liquid is automatically pulled between them by what is called capillary action. This process is fast enough to fill the gaps with nectars each time the bee dips the tongue in and holds the liquid so it doesn't drip. This means bees can cope with even nectar's viscosity changes. You don't want to starve just because your meal's got thinner, says Patrick Spark of University of New South Wales, Australia, who wasn't involved in the study. Okay, this is a conference report by James Lovelock, the James Lovelock Centenary. So James Lovelock himself is alive, so this is the thing. And, Gaia. This is the idea that the planet is a living organism. For the first time in history, Earth's ecosystems have been shifted by a conscious species. Will they thrive or fail? Asks Michael Marshall. The Earth is a complex machine that, works like to support life. And humans have seized the controls, for better or worse. That was the message at the conference held last week to celebrate the 100th birthday of James Lovelock, who famously came up with the idea of Gaia hypothesis. Lovelock's idea was that life on Earth acts to preserve its own existence by stabilizing conditions on the planet. Popularized in the 1970s, it inspired a generation of scientists who would study the Earth's many systems, from the climate and forests, and how they interact as a whole. Lovelock is famously independent-minded, and his idea attracted more than its share of eccentrics. This was evident throughout the conference, named The Future of Global Systems Thinking, celebrating James Lovelock's centenary and held at the University of Exeter, UK. At one point, musician Peter Horton of the Gaia's Company, a group that runs workshops and cultural performances that explored the Gaia hypothesis theme, sang a bouncy song about how everything about us is made of part of Gaia, and from our bones to our flatulence. The Silidus sat alongside a serious message. Humans are now pushing the Earth's systems out of whack, for instance, by releasing more greenhouse gases than living organisms can mop up, so heating up the planet. As a result, July may have been the world's warmest month on recorded history. Scientists at the conference described many impacts of humans by having on the planet. For the first time in geological history, Gaia has conscious beings at its control, a situation dubbed Gaia 2.0 by Tim Linton at the University of Exeter, and philosopher Bruno Latour at the Sciences Po in Paris. Evidence that our impacts on the Gaia is harmful is overwhelming. Richard Winkelmann of the Potsdam Institute of Climate Impact Research in Germany described how warming the planet caused our greenhouse emissions is melting the great sheets of Greenland and Antarctica. The two sheets contain enough water to raise global levels by 65 metres. Suck on. Greenland ice sheet is particularly looks very unstable. Melting the top layer of the ice means that the new top layer is at lower altitude, where the temperatures are warmer. This means that it can actually be a critical temperature associated with critical elevation, which there is no other solution to but for Greenland to become ice-free. The enormous volumes of plastics we produce and often immediately throw away was highlighted by Tama Galloway at the University of Exeter. As plastic waste in the oceans become a widespread concern, some have argued that this is a cosmetic issue and not a fundamental threat. However, Galloway argues that this is a mistake because plastics are made of petrochemicals, so combined with climate change. She highlighted in the 2019 report by the Centre of International Environmental Law, which found that production and use of plastics will emit 0.86 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent each this year. This is equivalent to 3.8% of the total carbon emissions, says Galloway. So what would it take to repair the damage we have inflicted on Gaia's self-regulating systems and beginning to live sustainably within them? The solution, many delegates argued, is to redesign society and our culture so it's better to suit Gaia. To avoid dangerous levels of global warming, we urgently need to cut the greenhouse gases emission. However, we have left it too late to act on many scientists who are now looking at technologies to artificially remove and store atmospheric carbon dioxide. One such approach developed by Tim Flannery and the Australian Museum in Sydney is to scheme to grow seaweed in the open ocean by pumping nutrient-rich deep water to the surface. Once grown, the seaweed could be sunk, trapping huge amounts of carbon. That sounds interesting. That sounds actually possibly logical. At the conference, Flannery cited a 2012 study which estimated that covering 9% of the ocean surface with seaweed would remove enough carbon dioxide to restore the atmosphere to a pre-industrial level. However, many speakers raised the specter of unintended consequences of such engineering projects. For example, a huge increase in seaweed would deprive marine animals of oxygen. In fact, I think that's hard to think, because doesn't seaweed grow by producing oxygen? I mean, I thought it's a plant. And such ideas being considered all shows how desperate people are getting, Lynn told me. There you go. Does it depress me? I can't work it out. When you just read and it's... But seaweed produce oxygen, so I don't understand this. How birds got their feathers. Dinosaurs' sexual preferences may have driven evolution of flight. Colin Barris. Complex feathers may have originally evolved because birds, the dinosaurs' ancestors, found them sexually attractive. Many dinosaurs had simple feathers on at least some parts of their body. Paleontologists think they know why these first evolved. Early dinosaurs' feathers really are very hair-like, says Scott Person of Mars Brown Museum Natural History in South Carolina. As such, they're almost certainly for insulation like mammals' fur, he says. But what makes it hard to understand is why some dinosaurs then developed feathers that are more structurally complex and eventually became specialised flight in birds. These later feathers were stiffer and don't provide much insulation. Person and his colleagues, Philip Curie at the University of Alberta, Canada, think it wasn't natural selection but sexual selection that drove the complex feather evolution. If feathers helped dinosaurs secure more mating opportunities, they would have been a good reason to evolve to retain them, even if those complex feathers no longer provided insulation. Biologists know that sexual selection can shape feathers in dramatic ways. Most famously, they think peacocks evolved their elaborate tail feathers largely to impress peahens. Oh, God, that's so stupid. Yet Pearson and Cutie says that we have never considered the possibility that sexual selection could act as a bridge that helps sync the two episodes of natural selection. Then, in their scenario, dinosaurs like Tyrannosaurus evolved simple feathers through natural selection for insulation. Sexual selection then encouraged some dinosaurs, like Oviraptors, to evolve complex feathers for display. Those feathers then became sophisticated enough to allow small dinosaurs to glide. At a late stage, natural selection then shaped feathers for flight. Pearson thinks we might eventually find the other situations in which sexual selection serves as a bridge between episodes of natural selection. The implications may go beyond this example of dinosaurs' feathers, he says. It's possible this process has had a similarly impactful role on the evolution of many other organisms for which we don't have a clear fossil record. Sexual selection bridges might even have had a big impact on biodiversity. Today, birds are more species-rich than any other group found of land animals, with about 10,000 recognized species. The idea makes sense, says Steve Root of the University of Vermont. The more feathered dinosaur fossils are found, the more it becomes clear that the feathers and even wings did not evolve for flight. If I had to cast my bets, I reckon that the wings evolved as sexual slit display structures and then were later repurposed as xerofoils. To now, the idea, Brunette says, we need to collect more feathered dinosaurs. If elaborate feathers were unique to one sex, then they are a bird species like a peafowl, as they are in a peafowl, it would provide strong evidence that their evolution really was shaped by sexual selection. In their scenario, dinosaurs like Tyrannosaurus evolved simple feathers through natural selection, for insulation, sex selection, and then encouraged some dinosaurs, like Oviraptors, to evolve complex feathers for display. Those feathers then became sophisticated enough to allow small dinosaurs to glide. This stage, natural selection then shaped feathers for flight. Person thinks we might eventually find other situations in which selection serves as a bridge between episodes for natural selection. The implications may go beyond this example, dinosaurs and feathers. It's possible this process has had a similarly impactful role on the evolution of many other organisms which we don't have a clear fossil record. Sexual selection bridges might even have a big impact on biodiversity today. Birds are more species-rich than any other group of land animals, with about 10,000 recognised species. The idea makes sense, says Steve Boosett at the University of Edinburgh, UK. Quote, the more feathered dinosaurs' fossils are found, the more it becomes clear that feathers were, and even wings, did not evolve for flight. He says, if I had to cast my bet, I reckon wings evolved as sexually illicit display structures and they were later repurposed for xerofoils. To nail their idea down, says Brissett, we would need to collect more feathered dinosaur fossils. If elaborate feathers were unique to one sex, and then, as I with a bird like the peafowl, it would provide a strong evidence that this evolution really was shaped by sexual selection, he says. Folic acid may help fathers-to-be have healthier babies. Jessica Hamazu. Many women take folic acid supplements when trying to get pregnant. Now, it seems men hoping to conceive may benefit from taking it too. Vitamin folate plays a role in the healthy division of cells. Women who don't get enough early pregnancies are more likely to have babies who have problems with their brain, spinal cords, and so may be advised to supplement of folic acid, a synthetic version of folate, before and during pregnancy. In the US and Canada, folic acid has been added to foods like bread and cereal on a dietary basis since the 1990s. But mounting evidence suggests that folate may be also important for fathers-to-be. Studies in rodents show that the amounts of folate males ingest before conception influences the offspring's health. To explore the effects in people, a near-mountain cover of University of Navarra, Spain, and her colleagues assessed 108 heterosexual couples going for fertility treatments at a clinic in Boston in the US, and the resulting 113 pregnancies and births. Participants had to fill out a detailed food questionnaire so that the team could estimate each person's level of dietary folate. After accounting for factors like age and mother's folate intake, the group found that men who had more folate in their diets had babies with longer gestational periods. This is genetically thought to be beneficial for health. But, this is generally, but it's too early to encourage men to take folic acid, says Sarah Kimmins, McGill University, Canada. We haven't yet identified the optimal level of folate to produce the healthiest sperm. Consuming too much, it may be detrimental, she says. I would think, in terms of as far as article goes, that, I think, my friends, is crap. DeepMind's AI, the technical firm's latest algorithm, can detect early signs of kidney injury, but it's too soon to tell if it will save lives, says Donald Liu. So, but it's not too soon to put it in a New Scientist article. Artificial intelligence trained on health records can detect kidney injuries up to 2 days before it occurs. In principle, an advance warning could help doctors intervene earlier to prevent irreversible damage of kidneys, but hasn't yet been confirmed by rigorous tests. Niad Thomas, a research firm DeepMind, and his colleagues trained the algorithm to predict whether a person will develop acute kidney injuries, result in a drastic drop in the rate at which kidneys filter blood can be fatal if untreated. Using blood tests from medical records related to old hospital admissions, the AHR predicted whether the kidney injury would occur within the next 48 hours. His accuracy was determined by comparing prediction with the actual outcome at the time, where the records show the person was later diagnosed with AKI. The outcome was fairly accurate. At predicting most severe forms, it correctly predicted 90% of the cases in which the patient's kidney functions deteriorated so severely that eventually required long-term dialysis. It is hard for doctors to anticipate kidney injury, so the level of accuracy is significant, said Eric Tripple at the Skips Research at California. This is all a problem. It's just, you know, the herd, you know, the huge percentage, like the false negatives, it can be rather large. If you knew a patient group was going to have kidney injuries, there are many things we can do, said Tripple. These include adjusting the person's fluid levels, monitoring blood pressure more closely, and avoiding medicines that can hamper kidney function. However, the algorithm was less accurate than other forms of AKI, correctly predicting only 50% of all episodes, with a ratio of two faulty alerts for each correct prediction. So if you've got a huge population of people, false alerts can be pretty bad. The AIs was trained on more than 700,000 anonymized electronic records from the US military veterans, but only around 6% of these were from women, meaning AI is more accurate at predicting condition in men. The only way to be sure the technology will be helpful is to test it in a clinical trial where doctors intervene depending on the advice of the AI. So far, few algorithms have gone through such rigorous tests, but the new system may well be suited to this step. With the many medicines, AI, there could be serious consequences if they get things wrong. A false negative could mean a missed cancer diagnosis, for example. A false positive may lead to unnecessary treatment. But the potential consequences are less serious for AKI predicting AI, says Tabul. A missed prediction eventually will be picked up by a blood test, and false alerts aren't likely to have a negative impact, he says. That's because managing AKI usually involves checking fluid levels and blood pressure. At worst, it may mean a temporary withholding a drug that was toxic to the kidneys, which are likely to be catastrophic. But some barriers remain. With these kinds of algorithms, it's hard to be sure whether the predictions are based on. It is possible, for example, that the AI can assume knowledge of the lab tests in order to work out what doctors suspect is wrong. Clinicians might be hesitant to take the advice of such algorithms if it doesn't provide the clinical reasons for the predictions, says Joel Powell, Mary University, London. A further hurdle to developing such technology is that AI needs a lot of data and initial training, which is hard to come by. For instance, in 2016, the Royal Free National Health Service Trust in London produced 1.6 million identifiable medical records to DeepMind to test a smartphone app called Streams, which monitors the people with kidney disease. The UK data watchdog, the Information Commissioner's Office, later ruled the agreement failed to comply with the data protection law. Streams is now used by four NHS trusts in the UK, while this app doesn't currently make use of AI. DeepMind says it plans to add it to Streams. I don't know what this means then. Supercharged Stars charts course for intergalactic void by Will Gator. We've seen the stars zooming through the Milky Way so fast it'll eventually leave our galaxy. The so-called hypervelocity star named S5HV S1 is moving at a blistering pace of 1,700 kilometres per second. Astronomers have spotted other stars travelling faster than this, but those were dying stars thought to have been blasted outwards by a supernova explosion. S5HVS seems to have been on its way by an encounter with a supermassive black hole or at the centre of our galaxy, Sagittarius A star. The superstage star was found in the Southern Stellar System Spectroscopic Survey using the Anglo-Australian Telescope in New South Wales, Australia. The team behind the work thinks that this object might be once have been a pair of stars orbiting each other. When it neared our galaxy's center's holes, its intense gravity would have ripped them apart, flinging HVS into a small on its current source. It's usually hard to trace the origin of high-velocity cards, but not in this case. We can calculate quite precisely where this star is coming from, says Sergei Kopolov of the Carnegie Mellon University in Pennsylvania. It looks like it's coming straight from a tiny region that includes the galactic center. Yeah, it's a zone. We could learn a lot from objects like this. For example, by tracking the star's route, we might see how it was affected by the halo of dark matter in our galaxy's center. S5HVS1 is destined for a lonely end. It's on course to spend its final days sailing through the intergalactic space. Researchers estimate that it will be several million light years away for our galaxy when it finally burns out and dies. So that's actually, you know, not very long for a galaxy. You know, that's 7 million light years. You know, Andromeda's 2 million light years away. Turtle embryos may change sex by moving in the egg. Turtle embryos seem to influence their eventual sex by shifting around it within their eggs and seeking out the hot and cool spots. In some turtles, cooler eggs produce males and warmer ones produce females. That's a concern because climate change could result in one-sided sex ratios. Now the work suggests that turtles may have some ability to adapt this. Embryos can detect temperature differential within the egg and move to the optimum position, said Rick Shine of Macquarie University of Australia. He and his colleagues measured the temperatures of eggs in a type of freshwater turtle on Monterey River Sea in outdoor nests. The temperature was higher at one end of the egg, with a maximum difference of 4.7 degrees. The temperature difference needed to shift from develop as a male to develop as a female is only 1 degree, says Shine. There's enough temperature difference within an egg for an embryo to change the temperature by that much. Lab tests showed that embryos that couldn't sense temperature stayed in the middle of the egg, and either all males and females are hatched depending on the incubation temperature. Those who could sense it moved about up to 6 millimetres and about halfway of each sex. Friedrich Jans of Iowa State University says it's unlikely the embryos move like this. The yolk would always be in the way. The embryos would have to move twice a day to cope with the temperature fluctuations, he says. Yellow glasses don't improve night vision. Wearing yellow glasses while driving at night make you think you're seeing better, but tests and simulators show that drivers wearing them don't spot pedestrians any faster than those wearing clear glasses. In reality, yellow glasses reduce the amount of light entering the eye and thus what people can see at night, says Alex Haring of Harvard Medical School. It's like wearing sunglasses during the night time. Yellow glasses designed to reduce the glare of headlights on oncoming vehicles have been sold since the 1950s. The idea behind them is that because the blue light gets scattered more, filtering it out reduces glare. Such glasses are often advertised as improving night vision, and eye care professionals can normally advise their use. To see how these glasses might affect the performance of drivers at night, Huang and his team kitted out a driver simulator with high-intensity LEDs that can match the brightness of the vehicle headlights. When 22 people aged from 21 to 80 each did 8 driving sessions of about 10 minutes in the simulator, they sounded the horn every time they saw a pedestrian crossing the road. People wearing yellow glasses, the study used 3 makes sold commercially, responded a fraction of a second later than those wearing clear spectacles. The difference wasn't significantly significant, but Hong thinks it would be if the study were repeated with more participants. Well, wow. Volunteers all thought the glasses did help, though, saying the night scenes looked brighter. That means wearing yellow glasses make people overconfident, Huang says. Oh, God. Humans are great at smelling cheese. Smell that? If it's cheesy, sweaty, or sweet, what you might be lured to sense. Humans have evolved a lot of smell receptors for these scents, probably to help us choose the food to eat. Sursla and Siddhar Medicine of Katam and his colleagues looked at the smell receptors in mice and people. To do this, they analysed a patch of neurons that contained smell receptors. This area is some 2.5 square centimetres in the humans and sits between the eyes and the top of the nasal cavity. The team extracted mRNA from each sample. These molecules help genes to make proteins, so levels can indicate which genes were switched on, as well as their relative abundance. Both species have receptors for odours that smell like rancid milk or cheese, sulphur or sweat, or are particularly sweet and spicy smelling, like vanilla, clove and other smells. These help us make decisions about which food is safe to eat, says Salva. But in mice, the chemicals also act as pheromones that can influence their behaviour, such as scents to attract mates. They have lots of receptors for chemicals also found in bodily fluids like breast milk and vaginal fluid. But there's no evidence that these act as pheromones in humans. I wonder what pheromones really are. Small porpoises on brink of extinction. There may be only 19 vacos left on the wild. Numbers of the small porpoise, found only in Mexico's Gulf and California, have dwindled in recent years in an assessment using acoustic underwater sensors and estimated just how bad the situation is. UK Lyme disease cases are rising. This is from Ticks. The analysis of Lyme disease incidents in the UK suggests the infection rate to be three times as common as previously thought. The team estimated that 7,700 cases of Lyme disease in 2012 in the UK. This is far more than the usual estimate of 2,000 and 3,000 cases a year. Monkeys show their logical thinking. Monkeys have passed a test that shows that they have logical reasoning to solve puzzles. The finding adds a growing evidence that animals don't just make choices purely on maximised to create the reward they get. Well, whatever that means. Stamping won't kill this cockroach bot. They've tried to squash the pesky insect, only to see it scuttle off once you raise your shoe. You would have the same difficulty eradicating tiny robots because the simple machine seems to have been given the robustness of a common rock cockroach. It is true that I've seen someone squash a spider and, you know, I'll get rid of that spider and then they'll walk away and the spider rebuilds itself and runs away. It looks really like a cockroach moving on the ground, says Lee of the University of California, Berkeley. The prototype robot comprised of curves, rectangles and angled front legs. They're up to 3 centimetres long and weigh less than 0.7 grams. When electricity is applied, the robot body contracts and expands in quick succession. During these motions, the front leg strikes the door and helps propel it forward and speeds up to 20 centimetres per second, which is just unbelievably slow. The device can carry up to 6 times its own body weight, which is nothing. Once successfully transported a single peanut, for example, the robots easily survive on human steppings on them. Lynn says in the experiments, members of the team tried stamping on one device as with such force as they could muster. Although its speed was roughly halved, the bot still worked. Lynn says twisting one foot while stamping probably would have destroyed the robot, though. More work is needed to control the robot's movement, says Tim Helps at University of Bristol, UK, but he thinks they could be used for industrial context, perhaps for inspecting pipes or sewers. London's public spaces are rife with drug-resistant bacteria. Multi-drug-resistant bacteria are dotted throughout London from the swabs taken across the city. Nearly half the samples containing a common type of bacteria had a drug-resistant strain in them. Hermine McCrane at the University of East London and her colleagues swabbed commonly touched surfaces around the city, including door handles, stairwells, taps and shopping centres, train stations, lifts and reception areas and hospitals. They tested the swabs for the presence of Streptococcus, a group of bacteria used that can cause antibiotic-resistant infections such as MRSA. Out of the 182 swabs containing Streptococcus, 40.7% were resistant to more than one antibiotic, and out of 418 swabs from hospital containing bacteria, 49.5% were multi-drug resistant. Finding such high levels of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the general public setting is worrisome finding. So the macrome, most bacteria identified aren't usually pathogenic, but may cause infections in people with weakened immune systems. Sam Wong. slice of wood makes salt water drinkable. Filtering out seawater can take a lot of energy. A thin membrane of porous wood may fix that. A membrane distillation, salty water is usually pumped through a plastic film, the tiny pores that filter out the salt and allow only water molecules through. If you think traditional water filtration, you need very high pressure pumping to squeeze the water through. It uses a lot of energy, says Jason Wren at Princeton University. Wren and his colleagues have made a membrane from a thin piece of American basswood instead. This is more energy efficient and doesn't use fossil fuels-based materials like many other membranes, she says. Chemical treatments make the wood's surface slippery, so one side is heated so the water is vaporized as it flows over it. The vapor then travels through the pores to the colder side and leaves salt behind, condensing as fresh water. Doing so, this thin layer of water takes less energy and maintaining high temperature. To boil, it happens at the other pressures. Surely you'd get a salt buildup. That just sounds whack to me, honestly. I can't see what the logic in that one is. I think we are really up shit creek with spoof science. I'm sorry to sound like that. I sound like an old fart, but it does sound really crap science. Okay, and I'll just see how fast. Get your mind healthy on big advertisement going through here, and this next page here. Cease the IVF racket. Fertility clinics must stop profiting from expensive, unproven add-on treatments, said Claire Wilson. She was. There's so many things like, you know, global warming and obese people. Put those two things together. You know, that fat that person's carrying is so many, represents so many tons of carbon dioxide just out there. Belief, fertility clinics must stop profiting from their expensive, unproven adult treatments. The man's crotch covered only in his underpants. I was level with my head and twice as large as life. Luckily, it was only a poster and a trade exhibition for fertility doctors I attended in Vienna. It was advertising supplements aimed to boost sperm counts. Odd, given that the recent review concluded that evidence for effectiveness of such pills is inconclusive. It was the first time I had been to this conference, the annual meeting of the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology. I was both awed and appalled by what I heard. For all the good and reproductive technologies do, for all the joy they bring to the otherwise may have been unwillingly childless, the whole field is riddled with the pseudoscience. Since the birth of the first IVF baby, Louise Brown, 41 years ago, more than 8 million babies have been born keeping conceived this way. But many people who have IVF don't end up with the baby of their arms. Success rates varies, but overall, 1 in 4 IVF cycles lead to pregnancies. If the UK and many other countries, couples have often had to pay for IVF, as it is seen as an optional rather than life-saving medical treatment. It's unable to afford just one or two attempts. There is inevitably a lot of disappointment. To try to boost pregnancy rates, many clinics offer other options as well as the basic IVF procedure. Sometimes called add-ons, these usually add to the price too. Many were developed on a theory alone without clinical trials to test that they truly work. Last year, the UK regulator, the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, developed a traffic light system for IVF add-ons, giving a red if there's no evidence to improvement chance of conceiving, other if there's a little conflicting evidence, and a green if the evidence suggests it could be used routinely. Of the 11 add-ons it reviewed, none got a green. Some of these procedures now belatedly going through trials. During the conference, researchers announced trial results showing that two widely used add-ons gave no benefit for most peak couples. One is freezing embryos for a month or two before putting them in the uterus. The other technique is called ICLS, which involves sperm being injected into the egg. ICLS is developed to help couples that where the man's sperm cannot swim, but is now offered to anyone. Cycles done this way outnumber the regular IVFs 3-1. When I spoke to attendees at the conference, several agreed that things were bad. Some were insistent that their clinic didn't carry out such practices unnecessarily. Others justified offering these procedures by saying couples are asking for them. That isn't good enough. Doctors can always refuse any treatment if they feel it's someone's best interest. If there's no good evidence that the procedure boosts pregnancy rates, it shouldn't be offered commercially. Those clinicians who are generally researching new procedures should carry them out only as part of trials where they are provided with free of charge, as in most other areas of medicine. Anything else risks exploiting the desperate and the vulnerable. Beautifully written thing, Leah Crane. Beautiful. And it looks as though I will be locked out of my computer forever. It's so many gigabytes it's going through. I'll see what it's doing. Star spotting science. Chandra Prescott Weston, assistant professor of physics and astronomy. She looks amazing. Core facility member at the Women's Studies, University of New Hampshire. Yes, honey? Okay.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.